Greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line. Here we are on a Thursday, third program of the week, sort of getting a little bit of a head start. Road trip number two begins next week, and in fact, I have a program to do in South Africa while right at the beginning of the road trip at midnight my time. So that'll be a first. Should be fairly quiet in the RV park at midnight. Won't be able to see anything outside the doors, but windows, anything like that. But it'll be interesting. So so what that means, of course, is once the road trip starts, lots of variability, as in time during the day. Maybe on I might bug Rich into doing a Saturday program if that's what the travel makes easiest to do. And of course, Rich has got to get ready to get out to G3. He's going to be out there too. He's going to be trying to endure the masked Nazis on the American Airlines flights. If you're flying American, I don't know. It just seems to me that most of the masked Nazis are on American, and that's what I'm hearing anyways. And I'm like, oh yeah, the 2-year-old with asthma. Oh wow, did you see that video? That is just simply disgusting. Disgusting. I mean. There was a day when everybody involved with that would have been fired, but not anymore. You know, now it's just, hey, you got a 2-year-old with asthma, you don't get to fly. That's all there is to it. Don't even bother trying. We don't want you. Get out of here. That's how things are going. But anyways, so you're not a 2-year-old with asthma, so we'll see. But I ain't doing that anymore, even though I am still technically executive platinum on American Airlines.
Really?
I am sometime in February. Yep, because they extended it a year because of COVID. So technically, not that it matters, but my wife has reminded me that we need to definitely do something with all those miles to make sure that she gets them in some way, shape, or form. I normally would not be a person picking on American because my wife worked for American. Started with America West is what it was called back then. That was a friendly airline, if you remember those days. And then they merged, and all the merging took place, and the Borg took over the airline industry. But, wow, hearing all sorts of nastiness going on out there. And why? Well, because of COVID. And I promised on the last program that there was an article. I had a number of people writing me, what is that article and stuff like that? I linked it. And I will try to link it again, that I read that was one of the most sober, clearly written pieces that I've read. And some people say, well, why have you gotten so much into this? Well, aside from, you know, like the lives of my grandchildren, someone on Facebook posted a television news story. A news station did a story about someone who got COVID and was in ICU, and somebody along the way started posting their stories about their vaccinated relatives who ended up in ICU or died or whatever else, and it just exploded. Thousands of people flocking there to post their stories about what has happened because no one will talk about it. It violates the narrative. You're not supposed to talk about these things. Everyone's supposed to believe that everyone who's sick and everyone who's in the ICU is the unvaccinated. It's the plague of the unvaccinated, the epidemic of the unvaccinated. It just isn't true. Some other countries are admitting it and trying to do something about it. Not there's much they can do about it. But anyway, this article was one of the best I've read on this particular subject. Any article that is going to attempt to discuss mRNA vaccines or DNA vaccines like the J&J, which are primarily the vaccines being used in the West, it's interesting the Chinese aren't using them. So strange. Why did we? Well, I have a feeling we're going to find out for long. But any article you're going to read that is going to be worth anything is going to have a certain level of complexity to it. There are certain terms, and just as in theology, the same is true in biology. Most of the time, something is difficult to understand simply because you don't have the vocabulary. And people sound super smart when they're saying things because they have the vocabulary and they can use the vocabulary with ease. Once you learn the definitions of terms, you can demythologize a lot of scholarship. And so I've been a little disappointed with how many people have said, well, you know, that's just, I can't understand that kind of stuff. Look, this is what we're dealing with. And so, you know, turn the TV off, go to dictionary.com and do some work. Do a little homework, serious homework, self-education if that's what needs to be. But we're facing extremely important decisions, and we need to know what in the world is going on. And so, anyway, I will link to the article again when I post this program, so that you can just click on it. It's already on Twitter and Facebook and other places where I've linked to these things. But I said that I would read a couple of paragraphs of this particular paper, because I think it's that important. And so I shall. So I'm picking up a few paragraphs in to this particular paper. This is why experts currently look at the impact of mass vaccination campaigns either as at a glass that is half full, the vaccines work, or one that is half empty, the vaccines don't work well enough. That is precisely the issue. A vaccine that only prevents hospitalizations and severe COVID-19 disease is not good enough to be used to combat a pandemic. From a global or even public health perspective, these are therefore not the right criteria to evaluate the success of vaccination campaigns deployed during a pandemic. Using these criteria as an indicator of the level of control over the pandemic will inevitably lead to a further escalation of this morbidity and mortality rates. There should be no doubt that non-transmission blocking vaccines, that is the so-called leaky or imperfect vaccines, which is what we have right now, can never, ever control a pandemic. Even though they may be temporarily protect against disease, only temporarily? Yes, indeed. Given the globally increasing immune pressure and concomitant infectious viral pressure. I'm sorry, it just jumped on me here. There it is. Genomic epidemiologists have no doubt that this pandemic roller coaster will not stop before it takes us over the cliff into the abyss of complete viral resistance to anti-spike S antibodies. That is where all runaway trains of the different ongoing pandemics of highly infectious variants will be coming together and converge into a big swirl where they can no longer be distinguished from one another. The first stages of this evolution is what we now begin to see in countries that have already massively vaccinated their population, for example, Israel. There is no doubt that other countries, like the United Kingdom and the United States, will soon go down the same path. Due to increasing resistance to neutralizing anti-S antibodies, that's ABS, these countries are now even beginning to shift from a primarily beneficial, that is, less susceptible to severe disease, to a primarily detrimental effect, more susceptible to severe disease, in the vaccinated as compared to the unvaccinated. And then a paper from the UK government is linked at that particular point, if you want to take a look at it. But hear what he's saying. These countries are now even beginning to shift from a primarily beneficial, less susceptible to severe disease. That's been the thing now. Because remember, when the vaccine first came out, it was, I remember reporters asking the big names, so once I get the vaccine, then I can't pass this on to my loved ones, right? Well, you know, we're not sure, but, you know, that's probably what's going to happen, da-da-da-da-da. And now, as the goalpost once again runs into another stadium, what's the narrative now? the narrative now is if you've been vaccinated, you might still get COVID, but you're not going to get really sick. That was the new one. That when they came out, was that what we were told? No. No. Evidently, the world population has a memory that is significantly shorter than that of an elephant, that's for sure. And so they just keep changing stuff as it goes along. So now, right now we're being told is get vaccinated and you won't get as sick. This is saying these countries are now even beginning to shift from a primarily beneficial to a primarily detrimental effect. Whereas what it's saying is the vaccines make you more susceptible to severe disease in the vaccinated as compared to the unvaccinated. I want to be in the better group. Okay? You want to be in the better group. You want your grandchildren and your children to be in the better group too. The current situation is highly problematic, as all segments of the population will dramatically suffer from a situation where anti-SABS still binds strongly enough to suppress the vaccine's innate immune response against non-mutable, highly conserved coronavirus, COV, motifs, while no longer being able to sufficiently neutralize highly infectious variants. That's where it gets complicated. We're talking about binding sites. We're talking about one of the problems here is that these vaccines that we've developed, which are experimental and new, are extremely targeted. They focus on one tiny protein substructure in the spike protein, which can be easily changed through natural selection. The problem is, since that then creates antibodies without T cells, this leads to what this is going to mention, and I'll continue on. Instead, poor binding affinity of anti-RBD, RBD is receptor binding domain, ABS to SARS-CoV-2, S protein, as a result of mutations in the N-terminal domain, NTD, that's where it gets confusing, could tip the scale in favor of infection-enhancing ABS and thereby make vaccines prone to suffering AB-dependent enhancement. What is that? ADE of COVID-19 disease. Two papers cited after that. This is what we mentioned. I haven't gone back to find out when I first mentioned it. I think it was in December of last year when I first read about concerns, and these were from papers from like 2014, 2016. This is before coronavirus, where mRNA vaccines had been used in other contexts and had produced what's called ADE, antibody-dependent enhancement, that because of their narrow targeting and the fact that they produce an immune response that is not natural, they can literally make you indefensible against the next variant of the virus. Because your body thinks you're ready to go. Your body says, we've got the antibodies. We're good. No problem. And so your immune system doesn't respond, but because of the narrowness of the immunization, it misses this next virus that comes along, which is slightly different, and then there's no immune response, and you croak fast. You get sick fast, and there's nothing your body can do about it. That's not good. And that's why, for example, ivermectin has a much wider... A lot of people theorize that it actually binds at some of these sites in a much wider way, so it can deal with all sorts of different variants because it's not narrowly focused like that. So here is people talking about ADE. Viral resistance to these S-specific ABS is a terrifying thought, as spike protein is not only required but sufficient for enabling COV, coronavirus infectiousness, and pathogenicity. A couple more papers. This underscores the importance for each and every public health authority to look beyond the end of their nose to understand where this train is heading instead of focusing on intermediate stations, snapshots that, in contrast to the end station, look extremely different depending on a number of population-specific environmental and human influences. So what he's saying is, people aren't looking at the big picture. They don't want to look at the big picture. Seems like they're being very much encouraged not to look at the big picture by certain people who are becoming outrageously wealthy through this entire situation and getting an outrageous amount of power and authority. So, like I said, I will link to this. It's called The Last Post. Geert Vandenbosch is the author. And again, if all you see is someone attacking the author rather than dealing with the arguments, then you know that you're dealing with someone, probably a bot, to be honest with you. I think in social media, I think half the people that I've tried to engage on this subject ended up being bots because they disappeared after a while. They may have responded once, very frequently didn't respond at all. And we've all seen the pictures. And again, these pictures could be faked. But it makes sense, again, looking at where the money's going, these pictures of all these posts in social media saying the same thing from different sources, different accounts, making the same personal claims. And so I just wonder just how many of these are bots. But I will link to this so you can read the whole thing and give due consideration. But it does seem that right now we're facing a situation where we're being told by people who've changed their stories every 2 weeks for who knows how long, who are supposed to be experts in all this stuff, that now what we need to do is we need to start doing booster shots. And I know people who've already gotten booster shots. You know, Rich, you can go ahead and cough and not worry about the entire program ending. We have a single person audience, and you know, he's getting older, and you know how when you get older stuff doesn't work right anymore, and so he was just breathing normally and then stopped breathing normally, so it's just,
it's not the COVID.
He already had it. He has the good kind of immunity, so don't worry about it. But I see him back there trying to keep the cough from happening, and he's turning red and purple, and his face is exploding, and I'm afraid he's going to destroy his eardrums and stuff like that. Go ahead and cough. The world's not going to end. You don't have a microphone right in front of your face. It's okay. The world, it's all right. It's okay. So now you know exactly what's going on elsewhere in the studio. And the King James only guys, yes. Gail Ripplinger struck you dumb. And that allowed me to take a drink of water. All right. Real quickly, now I don't get who's in charge of the CDC. Sometimes this chick is, sometimes the other chick is. I don't know. They're both in the CDC. Leanna Wen, she used to be the head of Planned Parenthood, so that gives you an idea of the cultural perspective here. We are dealing with the culture of death. And anybody, I'm sorry, anybody, and this is one of the problems, because I was raised to respect the medical community and the Hippocratic Oath and all the rest of that stuff. Folks, that was all based upon a worldview these people could not even begin to conceive of. An oath? Fizzing chemicals, taking an oath? Who cares about oaths any longer? That's back from honor stuff. That's back when you thought that you were made in the image of God, and who worries about stuff like that anymore, right? So you've got the former head of Planned Parenthood involved in all this. But we saw this brilliant, brilliant statement. Remaining unvaccinated and going out in public is equivalent to driving under the influence. You want to be intoxicated, that's your choice. But if you want to drive a car, that endangers others. No one should have the choice to infect others with a potentially deadly disease. Now, those of us who can still think logically and rationally recognize that Dr. Wen cannot, and that should frighten us, that someone who has been given such authority, an unelected official, could present such a horrifically bad argument. Because this is why these folks will never do debates. Because in a debate, you're supposed to be able to ask those wonderful things called cross-examination questions, where the person has to answer consistently. And if they don't answer consistently, you can point that out for everybody to see. The assertion that your refusal to inject an experimental genetic therapy into your body, which, as we just noted, and as we are noted, more and more papers are coming out all the time now, telling us that in the UK right now, the majority of deaths in the UK are amongst the vaccinated. That is not a question now. They were saying, they got away with it for a few weeks. They were saying a few weeks ago, oh, it's just all in. No, it's just not true. And papers are out documenting that vaccinated people carry 250 to 300 times the amount of virus. And they know this. You know how I know they know this? This is why they went back to masking. Now, masking doesn't do anything about this, but they know that the vaccinated are super spreaders. And so the only thing you can do about it is mask them up again. Not that it's going to change anything, but it looks like you're doing something. It's that thing today where do something, whether it makes it worse or not. That's how our government works today in the West. The whole thing is, did you try to do something rather than did you actually succeed? That's the problem that we have today. But so the vaccines are failing, and they are making people super spreaders. And so why should I, again, still don't have long-term safety data. We already have more than sufficient short-term information about the dangers of myocarditis. Oh, and I should have brought this up. Isn't it fascinating the stories that don't get told today? Eric Clapton, did you see this?
Right.
Eric Clapton, one of the world's most famous guitarists, has put a video out where he says, well, I got vaxxed, and within a short period of time after the second vaccine, we're talking hours or days, I just crashed. He lost the use of his arms for 3 weeks. Eric Clapton. As he recovered, well, as he put it, his immune system is turned upside down. His health has been radically affected in a negative way, but he can use his arms again after 3 weeks. Can you imagine before 2020 any kind of a context where that would have not been front page news? Where everybody would have been, Eric Clapton? Experimental vaccine causes Eric Clapton to not be able to use his hands for 3 weeks. And what Eric is saying is, hey, no one told me this was a possibility. All I heard was how great and safe and everything else this stuff is. And the point is, you probably didn't hear about that, did you? Because of the control of the narrative. That tells you everything you need. If you're telling the truth, you don't have to censor the other side. You can simply refute the other side. If you're not telling the truth, you censor them. You just get rid of them. And that's what will eventually happen to all of us. So anyway, here's going back to the tweet here. So the false narrative here is that intoxication, which fundamentally impairs your ability to do what you're supposed to be doing, drive a vehicle, is being compared with remaining natural and not exposing yourself to all sorts of unknown dangers, long-term effects, and now making it so that you can become a super spreader. It doesn't stop you from getting it. It doesn't stop you from hospitalization, and it won't keep you alive. So this is totalitarianism. This is preying on the weak-minded to give them even further reasons. I mean, you are literally trying to get people to hate each other and to be violent toward each other. That's what you're trying to do. That's what these people are up to. And since they are wholeheartedly committed to the culture of death, they don't care if that results in death. They don't mind. That's okay for them. That's what we're up against. I saw the, some of you may have seen video this morning of this poor woman in Target and this mealy-mouthed, feminized, little, wimpy man is following her around, telling her about how what a bad person. And of course, he's all masked up, and he's actually wearing a sticker that says he's vaccinated. But he's literally following her around, telling her about how terrible she is. Finally, other women, I don't know where the men were, other women start getting between her and the guy and say, hey, it's her choice, get out of here, back off. Some of them were wearing masks. And eventually, a security guard walks up and is sort of keeping him from, you know, at least some distance. But it is, I'm just glad I wasn't in that Target. Because I'm not sure I'd be a free man right now. That kind of behavior is just, oh, those kind of people. All right. Before we get back to Hank and Eucharist and important stuff like that, Chris Bolt went for it this morning. Chris Bolt said what needed to be said. He said, can you imagine? Well, he said what I said. Can you imagine being a student at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and sitting there listening to the leaders of your denomination redefining plagiarism and calling it repentance? And of course, he's exactly right. I had an encounter after the last program with a fellow who used to work at the RLC. And somehow, but there is no Southern Baptist Deep State, only last month went from working at the ERLC to being on staff with Ed Litton, an ethicist. And I haven't seen any response from him to what I said, interestingly enough. But the point is, interesting how the ERLC is directly related to Ed Litton and to trying to defend Ed Litton. And clearly the Southwestern appearance was an attempt to get this behind them and move forward with the further redefinition of the purpose and intention of the Southern Baptist Convention. The fact that even Southwestern itself is promoting this conversation is truly troubling. It's truly troubling. A lot of folks had hoped that Greenway would be somewhat of a positive influence there, but obviously he's just part of the deep state. All the Southern Baptist Seminary presidents right now, the light's on them. If they don't come out and just name names and take a stand, then they're all in it together. All of them. Yeah, all of them. Even those that you may listen to on a daily basis. There isn't any question here. Here's my challenge to any professor at a Southern Baptist college or seminary. Define for your students what plagiarism is. In fact, all of you who teach the preaching classes, I want you to explain to your students how you will detect if they are plagiarizing someone else's work in the presentation of their sermons. And any definition you give will describe exactly what Ed Litton did, not once, not twice, but for years on end. So tell me how the president of Southwestern can sit there while Ed Litton says, I don't think that was plagiarism. While every single professor that works for him has to live with a different definition in the classroom. You want to tell me how that works? Isn't it obvious that you are saying to your students, rules for thee, but not for me? Sound familiar? We are so accustomed to the leftists in our government that when we see video after video after video of them palling around, no masks, no social distancing, and then the TV cameras turn on, or at least they think they're just now turning on. I can't believe these people are so stupid that they don't realize TV cameras are there. But they're palling around. Well, again, remember the Dalrymple quote? They do know. This is purposeful. It is meant to break you down. It's purposeful hypocrisy. But as soon as the cameras turn on, everybody throws their mask on. Okay, it's hypocrisy. How is this not hypocrisy on the part of the Southern Baptist leadership? The documentation is available to all. There is no excuse for anybody whatsoever on this issue. None. No excuses at all. It's there. It's clear. But I suppose we will have to illustrate one more time, and I'm not going to play the whole thing, but here, let's just play just a couple minutes, okay?
You are exactly like them. I compared it to if the earth were to say to the sun, I am sick and tired of you being in the middle of the solar system. If the earth were to ask the sun in our solar system, I'm sick and tired of floating out here in nothingness, surrounding you constantly. I want to be the center of this solar system. The sun might just say to the earth, all right, have it your way. The earth is 30,000 times smaller than the sun and would not have the ability to keep all the planets in orbit. And so the solar system would begin to unravel simply because the sun gave to the earth what it asked for. Folks, our entire solar system would fall apart. Why? Because the earth doesn't have the power of light and it doesn't have the power of gravitational force to hold this solar system in existence.
Oh, sexual disorder, that was the first thing, verses 26 and 27. Now we've got economic disorder.
There's economic disorder. Look at verse 29.
Social disorder.
He says there's social disorder.
Social disorder, just think Facebook.
That's just on Facebook.
Then you got spiritual disorder.
There's spiritual disorder there.
You could think of that as family disorder.
And there's family disorder. They disobey their parents.
You see, there are three ways I see us really going wrong with this in the church at large.
I'm going to tell you three ways I think we've gone wrong.
Number one, we believe that God doesn't really care about this.
First one is that we don't think God cares about this issue.
Okay, is that enough? I mean, there's so much more. There's tons more. But it's the same outline. It's the same material. It's the same sermon. And we could have gone through the illustrations. There was an illustration before this about the guy going to the temple and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But we could go to the one where he talks about the driver's ed teacher and he makes it his driver's ed teacher. It's the other guy's driver's ed teacher. And we could go through all this, borrowing the same illustrations, using the same language, same outline, sometimes word for word all the way through. This is called plagiarism. It's not, well, you know, some people have put some of my statements, we're talking about the same text, together with what J.D. said, but I don't think that's plagiarism. Okay, so here's my challenge to all of you defenders who are being paid to defend plagiarism on the part of Ed Litton. Define plagiarism without identifying what Ed Litton did as plagiarism. That's what you need to do. You can't, but that's what you need to do. And the fact that you can't do so means that you should simply step back and say, yep, it was plagiarism. And if what you're saying is, and that's perfectly fine, then just straight up say it, would you please? But to see entire entities, entity heads, and graduates of these institutions running out into social media saying that if you talk about this, you're hateful. I had some guy, everything James White says is hateful and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, as soon as you pop up, they don't expect you to see it. As soon as you pop up and challenge them, they run for the hills. They can't. They're not going to go toe-to-toe with you. They know they can't. You've got the data. You've got the arguments. They're not going to get anywhere. They know that. But here's the situation you face. And given what happened from the podium at the summer meetings, where people weren't allowed to do things and there was shenanigans with the motions and all that kind of stuff. Do you think this is ever going to, like, just get better? Don't you recognize that these people in the U.S. government have power and they're going to do everything they can to keep it, including corrupting the system? Same thing here. May I remind you that Russell Moore was a Democratic operative? If you see the parallels as to how they're operating, you might go, huh, interesting. But you have more freedom as a congregation of believers than we have as individuals in the society any longer. Because the convention can't come after you and throw you in the gulag. So the real question is going to become, how long do you put up with this? How long do you allow the ERLC to function off the monies that your people give, supposedly to protect Christians' ethical and religious liberties, and yet this is what the funds are being used for? How long does that go on? That's a question that a lot of congregations are asking. And this is just illustrative of it. This is just illustrative of it. Like I said, so much more, we could just let it go on. I mean, what was that, 2 minutes maybe? And there's so much more I could have done with just that single clip. So there you go. All right. Well, back here we go. We've got about the same, a little bit more time than we had on the last program. So once again, talk about a wide variety of topics. So we've gone from talking about spike proteins and narrow-focused immunization and ADE to Ed Litton's plagiarization of sermons for years on end and his unwillingness to admit that. And by the way, look, when you send people out from Southwestern to say, this was a wonderful example of repentance, man, that's frightening. Because he said it wasn't plagiarism. What is he repenting of? Not giving credit? Not giving credit? No, he plagiarized. He presented it as his own. That's a fact. And if you won't accept that fact, you're living in a fantasy world. And probably shouldn't be trusted to be leading a church. So, anyway, amazing stuff. On the screen, we have Hank Hanegraaff, Francis Chan, Metropolitan Ioannin. We have no longer the Bible Answer Man, but the Eastern Orthodoxy Answer Man in Hank Hanegraaff. And we have been responding to his historical and theological claims. And you may recall at the end of the last examination, he made the claim about the church uniformly doing something. Now, as we pointed out in our responses to others, which are actually still ongoing, as we pointed out in responses to others, when someone makes a claim about absolute uniformity that happens to line up with their particular theological formulation, all of us, even when that is appropriately said, I would say that all Christians were monotheists. Well, a Mormon might say, well, we're not, and so you're being biased. So I'd have to substantiate that. You have to be so very careful in listening to people's uses of the early fathers, because they're not here to correct us. For all of them, we only have written sources. That means, of course, that those sources may not be complete. Those sources may not accurately represent what the person believed at this point in his life or a later point in his life. In almost every one of these situations, these sources are fragmentary. And they're... it's so easy to think of situations where someone writes a book on a subject and the last three chapters are extremely vital in understanding what their conclusions are, but what if they're missing? So, it's very easy to make broad, sweeping claims. It's different to actually delve into what someone is saying and substantiate your assertions from that point. And so, we won't redo it now, obviously, but we have in this very studio gone over some of the earliest sources in regards to other issues and demonstrated that other people's presentations were not exactly accurate or fair in their analysis of early writings. That's what we're looking at here with Hank's claims as well. And so we will continue on from where we left off.
The early church uniformly believed that when you partook of the Eucharist, you were partaking of the real presence of Christ, Jesus.
Okay, what does real presence mean? If you ask that question in a room full of Roman Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, all sorts of churches from the East, and a number of Protestant denominations, you're going to get completely different answers from even from the same group. So to say they uniformly believed in the real presence is a necessarily anachronistic claim. You are taking a later definition and you're pushing it back into the early church. Now, is it true that the vast majority of fundamentalists, evangelicals in the broadest sense of that term with a conservative bent in the United States have a significantly different understanding of what they are doing when they partake of the Lord's Supper than most early Christians did when they partook of the Lord's Supper? I would say yes. Is there a vast chasm of ignorance that should be dealt with on the part of most believers, modern believers in the West, regarding what Roman Catholics believe? Well, again, with Francis, who knows? But what Roman Catholic theology has taught, what Eastern Orthodox theology has taught, what the early church practiced, which was multiform, would that be helpful? Would I believe that that would actually enrich our own practice of the supper? I think that it would. Am I just doing this to have a better position to respond to folks like Hank Hanegraaff? Well, fact of the matter is, I can point to you YouTube sermons for years where I have addressed this subject. At PRBC, Apologia, did an entire series on our own confessional position in regards to the supper. We're doing a whole series that will probably end up being, I don't know, 15 to 20 sermons by the time we get done. And those are apologia-length sermons, which are not short, on the ordinances of the church. And I think it would be wonderful if we had more time to work through some of the stuff that we've done on this program, where within just the past couple of months, we've had situations where I've read through what was found in Ignatius, what was found in Clement, what was found in the Didache, and we've read the original sources and recognized that someone was reading into those original sources meanings that were not there. Do I think that's helpful? I do. Do I think that that's, is that something I wish everyone had time to do? Of course. Is it something everyone has time to do? No. No. I mean, there's lots of stuff going on in the world. There's a lot of people losing their jobs right now. And they're just working hard to make ends meet. And so right now, maybe not the time they want to be delving into all that stuff. But the fact remains that when people seek to move you away from where you currently are, they want to exacerbate in you disappointments in your current religious experience, and then offer you something that sounds new and exciting and might provide you with what you're not getting where you are. And for years and years and years now, I have seen converts to Catholicism, Orthodox, whatever it is, and they are attracted by this kind of the ancient church standing in the midst of time. This is how we've always done things. And wouldn't it be nice, given how fast everything changes now, to be a part of something that doesn't change? And that taps into an important truth. It just taps into it in an invalid way. And that is, there is something true and positive and appropriate about recognizing the common faith, not only that we have with people who look differently than us today. In other words, we know what defines the central core of the faith, and then recognize that there are people in this world that share those things with us, but they have negotiable issues that are different, and we are thankful that Christ is building his kingdom. And if you are positive about the future, you can think that there will be time in the future for us to get all on the same page, not maybe in our lifetimes, but you lay a foundation for that to happen in the future. If you always think that Armageddon is going to erupt before the end of the webcast, I'm not sure you're going to be overly concerned about what's down the road that way. I have to admit, Rich, I know exactly what you're doing back there. I'm just going to stop right here, and I'm looking at the screen. And this is what Rich has done. Rich has been sitting back there working on balancing the camera so that what he had made is right in the middle, and the two lights are balanced in the shot, and you got Hank down there, you got me over here, and he's sitting there feeling very, very pleased with himself.
I did that 3 shows ago.
Oh, he said he did that 3 shows ago. Okay. I just decided that I was looking at it, and I'm like, okay, I'll go ahead and acknowledge, you know, because he's always back there, you know, pushing this little thing and that little button there and all the rest of this kind of stuff. And that's, there's the result. Yeah. Yeah. Last time he was turning lights on and lights off. I'm sitting here going, what is this, alien invasion or something? What's, you know, I don't know what's going on. It's different. But anyway, I'm sorry. I was in the middle of something important there, and just, it's age. It's just, you can't remain concentrating on anything for any long these days. So what were we talking about? Something about church history. Yes, appreciation of not only people that are different from us now, but studying church history forces you to have deep appreciation for people who looked differently than you. But finding where that common core commitment is. And it's not always easy. It's not a simplistic thing. But it does force you to err on the side of grace, especially because you can't look the person in the eye, you can't see the life that they lived. All you've got is what either their friends or their enemies said. So there you go. There's your challenge in that context. And so you develop your biblically defined Catholicity with a small c when you study church history. Because there are a lot of... If you define yourself as the standard of what it means to be a Christian, you're going to eventually come to the conclusion that the church hasn't done very well for a long time. And won't do very well after you're gone either, for that matter. So, I'm not sure why I stopped to say that, other than I am well aware that one of the reasons that, for example, fundamentalists pretty much avoid any meaningful study of church history. The Trail of Blood is not a meaningful study of church history, by the way. Is because of the fear of exposing their people to other viewpoints. Now, if I remember back when this ministry started, that was a fear that was expressed to us at the church we were at a number of times in the early years. We're not sure we want you teaching a class on Mormonism because we just don't really know if we want to have our people exposed to these other perspectives and viewpoints. Well, I get it. I think there's a fundamental distrust of the vigorousness of your own truth and presentation and faith, and certainly a distrust in the Spirit's ability to keep people in the truth. But there's no question that I have seen many, many people move from religion to religion over my lifetime. And some might say, well, if they just hadn't heard the other thing, they'd still be where they were. Well, maybe. But if they are so shallow, the only thing that comes to my mind are the plants that grow up from those seeds and what that can result in. And if you don't have deep roots, there can be serious problems and you can move from one place to another quite easily. So anyway, with that in mind, all of that to say that you will find people talking about the presence of Christ in the supper in ancient history. And you find something very similar in chapter 30 of the London Baptist Confession of Faith. And that is a belief that Christ is with his people in a special way when we are obeying his specific command to eat the bread, drink the wine, and to proclaim his death until he comes. That he is pleased with his people. That he is with his people. I am with you until the end of the age is concentrated and made true in a special way when the people gather to do what Jesus said and to proclaim his death by which they have been redeemed. That is as far away from a representation or an unbloody sacrifice, or however else you want to put it, as it can be. A representation in an unbloody manner, that's Rome's perspective. Some kind of transubstantiation. Well, even the East would say that Rome has gone too far. But you'll notice in what's going to come afterwards, and I'm sorry I took so much time here, what's going to come afterwards is that when Hank starts talking about the Reformation, he misses, ironically, the essence of his own childhood background on this subject. I was interested that when Hank and I were friends and communicating with one another, that though he claimed to have had that Dutch Reformed background, his knowledge of Reformed literature and theology was absolutely abysmal. It was minimal at best. And so he ends up contrasting Luther and Zwingli and doesn't even seem to recognize that Calvin was a mediating position between the two. But we won't get to that if I don't press play at some point, huh? So
said, "This is my body. This is my blood." He wasn't speaking metaphorically. He said, "This is my blood. This is my body."
He is speaking in the midst of the most metaphorically, allegorically rich experience of the Jewish people. Right? Passover. Everything on the table had a meaning outside of its literal existence. The bitter herbs, the suffering of the people of Israel, right? So, if you're in the midst of that context, and you say, "This is my body, this is my blood," and that sacrifice has not yet taken place, what other terminology are you going to use? Well, this is where Rome has dogmatically defined, and go back, I wish we had the video, but we have the audio anyway. Go back and listen to my debate from decades ago now. Three decades. Wow. We should have done something in January. We missed it. We've been too taken up with other things. We should have done something special about the 30-year anniversary of my debates with Mitch Pacwa in San Diego. Because one was on the Mass. And you will hear Mitch Pacwa in that debate argue that by commanding the apostles to do this, that command to them specifically ordained them as priests, because Jesus was presenting himself anticipatorily, but he was presenting himself even in that context. And was making them priests in so doing. So, I think that the most literal, meaningful, contextual reading of Jesus' words takes into account the fact that they are sitting in the midst of symbols, and hence their natural reading of what Jesus said would not have been some type of concept of transubstantiation. They were not Aristotelians. They would not have had any idea about what any of that could have possibly meant. They would have understood his discussion of the new covenant. You've got Ezekiel, you've got Jeremiah. That becomes the context for the apostles.
And the disciples took him at his word. If Jesus says, "I am the door," we believe that Jesus is saying he's the entrance to the kingdom. When he said, "This is my body, this is my blood," this was a hard saying, and many left because of it.
Okay, now there is a, and we'll have to finish up with this, but there is a wildly bad misuse of the scripture right there. I hope you caught it. What is he referring to there? He's left the institution narratives. He's gone to John 6. And in John chapter 6, he's gone back to the end. How'd you get over there? Over here, thank you. He's gone to the end of the text, the end of the discussion, after the disciples have gone away. Well, actually, it's the words. Here is the discussion. Verse 60. Therefore, many of his disciples, when they heard it, this said, "This is a difficult statement. Who can listen to it?" But Jesus, conscious that his disciples grumbled this, said to them, "Does this cause you to stumble? What then if you see the Son of Man ascending to where he was before? It is the Spirit who gives life. The flesh profits nothing. The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and are life. But there are some of you who do not believe. For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were who did not believe and who it was who would betray him." And he was saying, elegan, imperfect, the imperfect, repeatedly saying over and over again. And he was saying, "For this reason I have said to you that no one can come to me unless it has been granted him from the Father." That's John 6:44. He's repeating the same thing over and over again, and it's on the sovereignty of God and his centrality as the means of salvation, that no one could come to him unless it's granted by the Father. As a result of this, now in Greek, it's udais dunatai althein prosme. No one is able to come to me, eon me, unless a dedamenon auto ek tu patras, unless it has been granted to him ek tu patras, from the Father. Very next words. Ek tutu paloi ekton mapeton autu ap elthon aista apiso. Because of this, many of his disciples went away from following him and were no longer walking with him. Because of this, what? The emphasis upon the sovereignty of God and the necessity of God's drawing. That was why they went away. Not because of some doctrine of Eucharistic theology that would come about at some point later on. So I wanted to catch that and show you, because they're going to say, well, that's what John 6 is all about. Well, no, that's not what John 6 is all about. And we have argued that for a long time. You can look up the debates. We've done it with Roman Catholics. Fatal Flaw, Answers to Catholic Claims, Roman Catholic Controversy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, deals with those issues over and over again. So, all right. There you go. You ready to do the music this time? Because I was told that I finished up too quickly on the last program and couldn't get the music started fast enough. So I'm giving you a big heads up. We're getting ready to ride off into the sunset here. Wrap things up. You can start the music. There you go. We're going to do it nice and smoothly this time. No sudden stuff. Thanks for watching the program. I hope that YouTube doesn't take us down. Probably will, but there you go. We're still flying under the radar. Great. Thank you. We'll keep doing it as long as we can. See you next time. God bless.